This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with another examination of the evolving media echo chamber. We all know the internet is a moving target, and so our concerns about it can yo-yo. The fact that we can now choose among myriad information streams allows us to cherry-pick our media diets so we encounter only news that reinforces our worldview. Back in 2004, University of Chicago professor Cass Sunstein, who now works for the Obama administration, said that we should be afraid, very afraid.
The greatest danger of the echo chambers is unjustified extremism. So it's a well-known fact that if you get a group of people who tend to think something, after they talk to each other, they end up thinking a more extreme version of what they thought before. And the danger of that is you can make a situation where people demonize those who disagree with them. And that's an ongoing threat to our democracy.
That gave me the willies until 2009 when I spoke to Lee Rainey of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. He conducted a study of people's behavior on the internet during the 2004 presidential campaign.
One of the surprising things we found in that survey was that those who are the most technologically adept and those who are the most engaged with information actually are not in the echo chamber pattern. They are actually seeking out and finding out more arguments opposed to their views than those who are less technologically adept and less interested in political information. The most technologically adept people are, you know, scanning every horizon they can, and they can't help but bump into stuff that doesn't agree with them.
So I stopped being afraid. Until last month, when I spoke to Eli Pariser, author of The Filter Bubble. He said that Google, which once ranked search results solely on popularity, now personalizes results according to our online clicking behavior. In fact, there's a whole industry based on gathering information so that websites and advertisers can serve us better.
One of the underlying dynamics here is that a lot of what this personalization trend is about is making the web a more passive experience, delivering information to you rather than you having to seek it out. Steve Jobs famously said, you have to have your brain on, you have to be leaning forward to use your computer. And that was sort of what was good about the internet. It was an interactive medium. What these companies are trying to do is make it easier and easier just to sit back and have the information passively come to you. And it would be sad if it went in that direction, because when you do get yourself on the hunt for information that's exciting and interesting and different, you learn a lot.
Can you give me an example from your own research of how the same search might yield different results for different people?
Earlier this year, I asked a number of friends to Google Obama and see what came up. Sure enough, you know, one person got the top link from the New York Times about Obama. The other person got the top link from Fox News. And there did seem to be a partisan tilt in the information that they were getting based on apparently what they had been clicking on before. You know, neither of them were even aware that their search results differed from each other at all. I mean, you can't see how much your experience of the web is redirecting you toward things that you're going to find palatable or you're going to already agree with.
One thing that you mentioned to us is that as a founder of MoveOn, you wanted to cultivate online a number of Facebook friends who were clearly conservative. And you did. You friended conservatives, but slowly but surely, Facebook caused them to fade away.
One morning I logged on to Facebook and they just weren't there. Facebook was looking at who I was engaging with, what I was clicking on, watching everything I was doing on the site. And it was editing my news feed to edit them out. It was saying, you say that you're interested in these people, but actually we know that, you know, you are interacting more with people who are like you. And so we're going to show you more of their stuff, and we're going to let these people fade away.
Eli Pariser, author of The Filter Bubble. Joe Turow, author of the forthcoming The Daily You, How the New Advertising Industry is Defining Your Worth and Your World, from Yale University Press, says we're living in a whole new internet ecosystem
that is looking at us, collecting data, analyzing it, predicting what we do, and then targeting us with ads, discounts, and eventually news and information. And while it's not going to totally take over our lives, it will certainly put us in buckets, I call them reputation silos, as we move forward that may be problematic for society.
Expand on the problematic aspect.
Let's say you have a family with kids, and the kids go online and they talk about what they do, and advertisers figure, God, this kid is heavy. Maybe he likes fast food. So all of a sudden, the son in the family starts getting fast food discounts. The daughter starts getting gym ads that talk about losing weight. The husband begins to be put into buckets that reflect probabilities about income, and all of a sudden sees more used car ads and old car ads. We will get TV commercials and even suggestions about what to watch based upon the buckets that were put in. And we don't even know how we're being described. We don't even know where those data are coming from. And yet they will shape the kinds of things we see in our lives.
Well, I won't say I'm not worried about the effects of personalization. I think in many ways we're still at a very early stage with it.
Jacob Weisberg, editor-in-chief of the Slate Group.
But this is a version, Brooke, of a concern that I've heard since the very beginnings of the internet. My complaint about Eli Pariser's type of thinking is it's totally unempirical.
And you tried to reproduce his results. What happened?
Well, he starts his whole book very elaborately with this anecdote about Google, and he says two friends of his searched for BP, British Petroleum, during the oil spill. And one of them got news about the oil spill, and the other one got investment results about BP. And I said, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, I just don't have any experience of people getting search results that vary that much. So I just set up a very simple experiment. I wouldn't make any claim for it, except that it's a better experiment than he did. And he wrote a whole book about it. And I asked, you know, some people, I used Twitter, and I said, can I have some volunteers, people with different politics, different parts of the country, to just do the same searches? And let's take some terms that are obviously political, Obamacare, and then just the names of, you know, John Boehner, Barney Frank. I had five or six people do this, and they all got essentially the same results. There were only minute differences, and the differences were insignificant.
The insurance consultant from Dubuque got Wikipedia entries for the first two congressmen ahead of the official websites, right, while the others got the official websites first.
Right. And then with Boehner, this was an interesting test. There was a kind of Wikipedia-type site, very hostile to Boehner, and everybody got that in the same place. Whether you're right-wing, whether you're left-wing, whether you're in Dubuque, whether you're in New York City. So I just don't believe what he says about Google, and I think that casts into doubt the larger way he raises the issue, not about whether this is something that could happen, but about whether it is happening.
But you yourself list a whole slew of efforts to create personalized news services, whether it's coming from the New York Times or the Washington Post or these personalized magazines for tablets that are based on our Facebook and Twitter feeds. These are all efforts to anticipate what news we are interested in and what news in which we have no interest.
But this is the interesting question. How personalized should personalized news be? Do you just want to get news about sailing and greyhound racing? No, even if you're interested in those subjects, you want them as a supplement, maybe an oversampled supplement, to what actually happened yesterday in the world.
In a rebuke to Pariser in your column, you wrote, "Why assume that when people have more options, they will choose to live in an echo chamber?" I think past behavior allows us to assume that to a large extent. Homophily, the tendency of birds of a feather to flock together, is wired in.
It's never been hard to live in an echo chamber. In fact, I think in many ways it's harder now and was easier before. People didn't used to have a big range of options about information sources. Maybe they had a local newspaper. They had the network news. There were three networks. You could make an argument that most of the country lived in a kind of bubble with a limited range of opinion in the days before the internet brought us this huge variety. But I just try to look at it in terms of my own experience as a starting point and the experience of people I know. On Twitter, you follow people you're interested in, and the people are a proxy for the subjects. So you think someone is good either in your field or another field you care about or some subject that's happening. You start to get this range of sources you've never heard from before. And I find that by using Twitter to personalize the news, I have hugely broadened my range of voices, of ideas. Now, I'm not saying that's absolutely a common experience either. I'm just arguing against the automatic assumption that, oh, because there's some kind of personalization happening, what the personalization is going to do is narrow us.
Once we encounter an information environment like the internet, which is driven by our choices rather than driven by the constraints of a professional editor, I think we have to take very seriously the notion that we might be giving ourselves only what we want to hear.
That's Ethan Zuckerman, senior researcher at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, who suggests that there may be something to fear, not necessarily in our technology, but in ourselves. Our online social circles, the wide collection of loose ties we assemble on Facebook and Twitter, can put us in the path of new ideas, but only if we want them. Pariser says that Facebook stopped sending him news from the conservatives he friended because he didn't interact with them. So is Facebook to blame or Pariser?
The question is agency. Did you choose to do this? Do you have control over it? Or is it happening to you?
Ethan Zuckerman.
I think it's worthwhile to be a careful critic of these algorithms, but I think the personalization that we all do every day by choosing what information we look for, choosing who we talk to and who we interact with, is a much more powerful force in limiting our exposure to different forms of information.
Everybody will say they're going to sign up for this kind of varied diet, just as everybody says their musical tastes are quite varied and unpredictable. And yet when we look at what they actually do, there's a much narrower range there.
Clay Shirky is a consultant, educator, and author of Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age.
Some of it may be because people's interests are in a narrower range. Some of it may be because people imagine that they have more time to explore the world than they actually do. Right? You know, there's a handful of coast-hugging eggheads who have all the time in the world to just experience the media landscape in its full, crazy, and chaotic glory. And we think everybody ought to do like that. But, of course, everybody has a job, and most people's jobs don't involve sitting around playing around with the web to see what it's doing today.
Right now, there are plenty of people at work on the problem of engineering encounters with unexpected information, of engendering what netheads call serendipity. For his part, Shirky visits group aggregation sites like Three Quarks Daily and Crooked Timber, sites with more than one editor.
And that gives me a more varied media diet than essentially using my own filters against the web would do.
But for the reasons he just stated, the group that seeks the ideas of people who think differently from themselves will always be small.
This is, I think, the great weakness in the work being done on these kind of serendipity options, is to assume that everybody somehow deep down wants to be surprised or challenged.
In fact, he says that the new media are exposing us to unwelcome information far more than back when we were limited to cable and the daily paper. The conservative and liberal blogospheres link to each other all the time, and it's degrading public discourse.
Constant exposure to the idea that people disagree with you actually enrages people. So the polarization, I think, doesn't come from us cutting ourselves off from people who disagree with us, but rather from the irritation of constant exposure to the idea that there are people who disagree with us and that they are also out speaking in public just as we are. I think that the threat of polarization is there, but I think that Sunstein's diagnosis of the reasons it happened were wrong. So in a way, the cure he proposed might make the disease worse.
The cure meaning greater exposure to other people's
views. Exactly right. Exactly right.
That's very dark, Clay.
You know, look, I'm a Madisonian. I don't think that you ever get rid of factionalism. I don't think that what we want is for each individual to become more moderate. I think what we want is for the democratic system to produce the kind of fights that lead to moderate outcomes, even if all of the participants are partisan.
2 years ago, Lee Rainey at Pew's Internet and American Life Project soothed me with data. I think I need to call him again.
More people nowadays say they get political news and information from sources that share their point of view than were telling us that a couple of years ago.
Oh, no.
At the same time, we see among the heaviest internet users, the people who presumably would have the most sophisticated filtering tools and the inclination to go into that echo chamber if they felt like it, those people are getting more information from more sources and a greater diversity of points of view than they have before. So it's a mixed picture.
How many of those latter people are there?
There are fewer of them than there used to be. We definitely know that there are fewer people now on any given day who get any kind of news. About a decade ago, it was about a tenth of the population. Now it's about a fifth of the population who say on any given day, I didn't get news from any source.
is the internet creating a situation that enables us to be and results in us being more intellectually isolated?
Possibly. Brooke, I had you in mind when I drafted this battery of questions that we ran in the post-election survey we did in 2010, and it shows you what a mixed bag this situation is. So I'm just going to read you a bunch of questions and a bunch of data to show you how confused and fun this world is for us to be studying. Would you say that the internet makes it easier to connect with others who share your political views or had no impact? 54% said it's easier for me now to find people who share my point of view, and 42% said it didn't make any impact. So then we asked them, which of the following statements comes closest to your point of view? The internet increases the influence of those with extreme political views, or the internet reduces the influence of those with extreme views by giving ordinary citizens a chance to be heard? 55% said it increases the influence of extreme views. 30% said it reduces the influence of extreme views, and the rest said they didn't really know. So again, people are worried about the echo chamber, particularly if it drives up the power of extreme voices. But then we asked people, do you think that the internet exposes people to a wider range of political views than they can get in the traditional news media? 61% said it increases the range of views. So that flies against the notion that an echo chamber is there, because the internet is providing a lot more people the opportunity to expose themselves to points of view that they wouldn't get from traditional media. The final question we asked, again, sort of our Brooke battery here. Thinking about the political information you find online, would you say it's usually easy or difficult for you to tell what is true from what is not true? 56 said it is difficult. 33% said it's easy. So this is just a more challenging information environment that, yes, is pushing more people towards people who are like them or towards points of view that are similar to theirs, and yet they can celebrate the fact that they are aware of more things, or they think their fellow citizens are aware of more things, because the internet just has allowed this proliferation of voices and niches to come into being.
Do you feel less sanguine about this echo chamber business now than you did, say, 5 years ago?
Yeah, there are more structures in place that potentially push people into echo chambers, but I don't think we fully understand yet the pathways of information in order to be able to say definitively, this is happening, it's bad, or this is happening in certain ways that aren't necessarily so bad. So it's a pretty mixed picture, and we haven't yet reached the end of the road with it.
I'm counting on you, Lee.
Brooke, there are so many more Brooke batteries for us to ask that I have confidence that we'll keep talking about this as long as your show is on and I keep getting funding.
Lee Rainey, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Ultimately, as Ethan Zuckerman observed, it comes down to choice. We choose echo chambers. In fact, we're wired to. But with conscious effort regularly applied, we can defeat that impulse by adding new circuits and connections to the standard array. The new technology makes it so easy and so hard.